hppodcraft.com.
North of Dunwich lies an all but abandoned country, one which has returned in large part after its successive occupation by the old New Englanders, the French Canadians who moved in after them, the Italians and the Poles who came last, to a state perilously close to the wild. The first dwellers wrested a living from the stony earth and the forests that once covered all that land, but they were not versed in conservation of either the soil or its natural resources, and successive generations still further depleted that country. Those who came after them soon gave up the struggle and went elsewhere.
I almost wish I can go elsewhere.
Yeah. Derlathis, in that paragraph, Derlathis accidentally setting up a metaphor. I don't know if we even want to pursue, you know. The soil around Lovecraft Country used to be fertile, but it seems everybody who revisits it makes it a little less fertile, makes what it produces a little less good.
Yeah. We are, of course, talking about a story by August Derleth called Wentworth's Day. And you may ask yourself, why are they talking about this guy, August Derleth, on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast?
Yes.
The answer is because this story was a posthumous collaboration with our guy, H.P. Lovecraft. And that's why we're talking about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are at hppodcraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
And who was that reader?
That reader is Dion Winton Pollock from over at the Geek Syndicate website. That's geeksyndicate.co.uk.
Yes.
He does podcasts. He writes for them. He's great. But also, he's got a book out called Sunny with a Chance of Zombies that you can pick up from Amazon.
That's a great title. That is much better than Wentworth's Day.
Oh, yes. I got to say, Pfeiffer, I'm excited about Necronomicon this year.
Yes, we are kicking it off this weekend, Necronomicon. As you're hearing the show, we are arriving in Providence to start the festivities.
I know. And I get to announce right now at this very moment our Lovecraft comedy quiz. And again, comedy is in quotes, has its two additional panel members locked in. It's already been listed that Paul McLean of yogsothoth.com is going to be the host.
So excited to see Paul again.
And Paul is wonderful to put eyes upon. Our other contestants, you, me, Andrew Lehman.
Yes.
And Ken Hyde.
Yes.
So the four of us together in one place for the first time ever.
Yeah.
It will be a thing of beauty or terrific devastation. Who can say?
Who can say? I just hope I can make it.
What?
Well, those guys are pretty smart. I figured I'd play it kind of cool. Like, yo, what? Maybe I'll show up.
What? No, you have to show up.
I'd just be like, this, whatever, guys.
Don't do that.
No, I am really excited that they're doing it with us. It's going to be really fun.
I was also super excited about this story, I have to say.
Really? Just from that excellent title, Wentworth's Day?
Well, no, when there wasn't the title. It was the first paragraph. They mentioned Dunwich.
Yes.
And I think, oh, yeah, maybe they're going to do some cool thing about the degenerate Whateleys, you know, that they talk about in Dunwich Horror. And I was like, oh, maybe they're going to explore some of those other family members. And we'll see what that stuff
yeah,
is.
Yeah, maybe this time there's triplets.
Exactly. Or maybe we get some kind of Yog-Sothoth aftermath, like psychic ripples in the space-time continuum because, you know, an avatar of Yog-Sothoth was on Earth. He manifested. He caused havoc.
Yeah.
There's so much great potential in this first paragraph. And it is potential that is not even slightly realized in the story. So get those expectations way down as we talk about Wentworth's Day.
No kidding. I mean, I thought maybe it would explore, as you said, some new avenues that were suggested by Dunwich Horror. But I also didn't want another Caddyshack 2 version.
Yeah, no.
You know, of Dunwich Horror, like the Innsmouth story was.
Right.
So I was glad it went another direction. Unfortunately, that direction was to be the Caddyshack 2 of Picture in the House.
Yes.
I mean, it was kind of a mashup of a couple of Lovecraft stories and even some pulpy nonsense. But I guess that's better than a single limitation of any one story.
Yeah.
In that I didn't know exactly what was going to happen. But
yeah,
partially I didn't know what was going to happen because it really didn't make a lot of sense. We can get into that, obviously.
Yeah.
In the end, it seemed like a Tales from the Crypt style story.
It did. It totally did seem more like a Tales from the Crypt.
Well, let's get into it.
Yeah, right. The story starts off talking about the old world that is north of Dunwich.
Right.
It's got some great old houses that are really worn down. The roads aren't even really roads up there, just two wheeled grooves in the forest. It's old and foreboding.
There are gambrel roofs, though. Very important to know that. Lots of gambrel roofs. And it was also believed a long time ago that witchcraft was practiced around that area.
Yeah.
Which, whatever. I mean, witchcraft was practiced everywhere, wasn't it, at some point?
Or some form of witchcraft.
Yeah.
So our narrator, this guy Fred, is having to travel near North Dunwich. Due to some road construction, he has to take one of these back roads. Mm-hmm. See how easy that was? I just did that right there?
In a sentence.
I know. I got you there in a sentence. four paragraphs of this guy driving around, details about the road construction. He had to make a left and then make a right and then go down this. It's like, come on.
Well, it was building a mood, but the mood was kind of unnecessary.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a waste of time. Well, we also know from this segment that in this is his last trip he ever took to the area that we're about to hear about.
Yeah.
So for some horrific reason, he won't go back. Maybe it's because it does take him so long to describe everything. You know, he's like, I don't want to go there again. After this, the character's like, I'm only going to the suburbs, you know, easy to describe, lots of houses. There's an Applebee's. It's fine.
Well, on one of these back roads, it starts to rain really hard. It's chucking it down.
Mm-hmm.
And these old cars, now the story set in the summer of 1927,
They
weren't great in the rain. So he had to go looking for somewhere to get shelter for his car, or it was going to get waterlogged. He passes this old farmhouse. It's got a name on the mailbox. It says Amos Stark. Now, I'm not sure if Amos, was he Ned Stark's dad, or was he Tony Stark's grandfather?
I thought about that, too, of course. I was thinking, though, that if Durleth were alive now, he would be the one that would be most on George Martin's butt about finishing that last book, because he'd already be writing his, you know, kind of hoping he would die. So you could be like, hey, could I just use a few of your first chapters and just have a go at it if you're not going to finish it? If not, it's cool. I'll just be working on my totally unrelated book, The Trial of Chairs.
Anyway, he notices that this farmhouse is wide open. So he just drives his car in there. It's dark. When he drives by, he sees that the house is dark as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's no lights on inside. When he gets in the barn, he sees that it's empty and there doesn't seem to have been any animals in there for quite some time.
This is old, dilapidated structure.
He doesn't stay in the barn, but he runs to the house and knocks on the door. This is the point that the picture in the house thing happened for me. I was just like, okay, this is a version of picture in the house.
And the mechanism was just a little different. It was like, instead of being on a bicycle in the rain, he was in a car in the rain. And there was a detour. There was a detour.
He pounds on the door and asks if anyone is home. He hears a voice from inside and it says, "Who be ye?"
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, we know we're in for some phonetic writing.
Yes.
He says, I'm a salesman seeking shelter. Whoever it is inside opens the door. There's a cacophony of locks and chains being undone. You can just all the sound he hears. And it's an old guy with a lantern. And he's described as a wizened old man with a scraggly beard half covering his scrawny neck. He wore spectacles but peered out at me over them. His hair was white, his eyes black. Seeing me, his lips drew back in a kind of feral grin, exposing the stumps of teeth.
But he says, a storm catched you, huh? That's how he greets him.
Yeah.
And I was, right away, I was just thinking back to Picture in the House. Isn't that almost the exact line of dialogue that guy says? Catched in the rain, be ya?
Yeah.
He just did a little twist on it. Just the way that he threw glasses on this guy. It's the same character as Picture in the House, but he threw some glasses on him. You remember when we did that fake April Fool's Day show and it was about, you know, Showbiz Pizza?
Uh-huh.
And I remember going to that restaurant later when it became Chuck E. Cheese, and I was so mad because they had just taken the same animatronic animals and thrown some different, you know, thrown a beak on them or dyed their fur. I mean, it just felt like betrayed, and I had the exact same feeling right here. Like, I know who this character is.
Yeah.
I know what you're up to.
So Stark invites Fred in, says, you know, come in and dry yourself. And then he starts to chuck a little bit, and he goes, "This be Wentworth's day. I thought you might be Nom." And he's like, "Oh, all right, I'm not Nom. My name's Fred Hadley. I'm from Boston."
Is that how you pronounce it, Nom?
Oh, am I saying it wrong?
Oh, I don't know. I was saying Nahum. Dude, I don't know. It says Nahum, you know, N-A-H-U-M. It might be. It probably is Nom. I don't know.
Nahum? Nom?
Wentworth is the most important one. We'll just use his last name.
Sure. Stark says he ain't never been to Boston and not even as far as Arkham. So he's a real local kind of guy. Fred says that he hopes that Stark doesn't mind that he put his car into the barn. And then Stark makes a little joke and says, cows won't mind.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's no cows in there. It hasn't been for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he rips on city folks in their automobiles for a bit.
Gotta have your automobiles.
Stark says that city folks have moved out here in the past, but they don't stay. Doesn't say why they don't stay.
No. We probably talked about it with Picture in the House or some of these other things at some point, but I always find it interesting when you get into this subgenre of horror about evil yokels.
Right.
Because that's what they're setting up right now. Oh, you're a town man. We don't trust you around here. I've never been that far. We have eerie customs out here in the country. And it's like, I've lived in both urban and rural areas. I think that there's a lot of paranoia that's created for people that are only city mouses, that have only lived in places where they have access to a lot of things. That if you go out there where there are farms, you know, you might get killed. And I think there's a lot of that anxiety in Lovecraft's work.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was a city guy. He did feel that there were civilizing aspects to that that might not be affecting the people who are out in the country. But it's really funny because I've had those conversations with people who've always lived in cities where they're like, oh, man, I wouldn't want to break down in the middle of nowhere because of those weirdos that live out there in their farmhouses. And meanwhile, there's a guy outside the restaurant window with sparklers in his hair jerking off. You know, if my car was going to break down anywhere, I would almost wish it was out in the country where there's somebody.
Oh, yeah.
They're probably resourceful, can probably help you. They're probably very pleasant people.
Yeah.
It's a type of paranoia that doesn't always sit well with me, I guess.
Well, no, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense. I think the perception is that people that are rural are less educated and therefore more primitive. Mm. And therefore more feral.
Right. But the most crazy things that I've seen have definitely been in cities, man.
Absolutely.
I wonder why there's not more urban paranoia movies. You know, sometimes there are.
Yeah.
And I think zombie movies actually play on that metaphor quite well.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it's something that I'm always a little suspicious of when I get into it.
Stark fumbles around in the kitchen for a bit, and this gives Fred some time to look around. And he sees that there's lots of old antique stuff. Well, I mean, I guess if it's antique, it has to be old. Spot some furniture that is definitely a couple hundred years old. So I mean
he could have got all this stuff from Restoration Hardware. Maybe that's what he used this money that he borrowed for. Well, at this point, I did think this guy's probably some evil immortal wizard, because we've gone that way already with Derleth's work. And the fact that there's all this antique stuff around, I thought, maybe he's actually been here for a very long time.
He also finds a bunch of other things around, like a turkey caul of leather, candle molds, wooden peg cork ink wells. Calabashes, which I didn't know what that was. I looked that up. Those are type of gourd that often gets made into like cups and bowls and things like that. Did you know what a calabash was?
I'm sure.
You liar.
Now that you've told me, you shouldn't ask me before you told me what it was. Now you'll never know if I knew what a calabash is.
No, I do know. You didn't know.
I know now.
Fred asks if he lives alone, and Stark rattles off some family members that he's had. Molly and Dewey, and Abel went off when he was a kid, and then Ella died with lung fever. I assume Ella was his wife, but she died 7 years ago, so he's been living there on his own for 7 years.
Right. So that undercuts the old crazy wizard thing.
Exactly, yeah. So I'm like, oh, okay, this is a little different. Things are getting changed up a bit. Fred notices that Stark seems to be a bit distracted, and he keeps looking at the door. Stark finally asks if he was alone out on the road, and then Fred says, oh, yeah, I didn't see anybody since Dunwich, and that was, you know, 17 miles, he figures. And then Stark corrects him and says 17 and a half.
And we are that way out in the boonies where you shouldn't have seen anybody.
Right. Yeah.
But obviously Stark is waiting for somebody. And the way that he had the door all locked up and triple locked and all that kind of stuff, and the way he's distracted and keeps looking at, I was hoping maybe, you know, some monster would come knocking at some point. I mean, it is doing his job of setting up that expectation.
Stark asks if Fred has been a salesman for long, and that if he knew Nam Wentworth. And Fred's like, no, I didn't. I don't know who Nam Wentworth is. Jeez, I'm from Boston. I'm delivering something out here. Why do you keep asking? And Stark says, well, I knew Nam better than anybody else. Look at this book right here. Seventh Book of Moses. It was Nam's. It was like, okay.
It's weird, great. Man.
Thanks. But the Seventh Book of Moses, I wasn't sure what that was. And it's actually a real, well, it's a book that's existed for a long time. It's a mythical text, but it's in print. You can actually get this.
Yes.
Because the first five books of Moses are what make up the Torah, or the first five books of the Christian Bible. Mm-hmm. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, right? Is that right? Supposedly, Moses wrote two more books that have magic stuff in them about like demons and creating amulets and all types of fun stuff like this.
Yeah, I think that if you follow the incantations in the seventh book of Moses, you can reproduce some of the miracles that are cited. It's like, hey, anybody can do this.
But I mean, it's pretty old. It was first seen in bits, like pamphlets, in the 18th century.
Right, in Germany, I think, is where it became popular.
Yeah, and then it got some proper printing in the 19th century. But it was really popular with American immigrants and became kind of the basis of Appalachian folk magic in the late 1700s and early 1800s.
Which would have been such a cooler setting and topic for this story.
Yeah.
I mean, Appalachian folk magic? What? I don't know anything about that. That sounds great. But I would say that just the mention of the book in the story was cool, because I was waiting for there to be a book of some kind, this being a picture in the house takeoff, and I thought it was going to be the same kind of thing. But then it was this, which I had to look up as well, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
What's going on? What's the significance of this? As it turns out, there's zero significance other than...
Well,
I guess, I mean,
It plays heavily into the story.
It does, but stupidly.
Yeah, ridiculously.
The reason I say, yes, it does have significance to the story, but I meant the fact that Wentworth had these books.
Right.
And then now he has them. Was Wentworth, okay, why was he reading it? Does Wentworth have some powers? What's the deal?
Yeah, you're right, he doesn't.
We didn't find anything out about Wentworth other than the, well, what we're about
to find
out.
Well, we find out some stuff right now because Stark tells him about what happened with Wentworth.
Oh, that name, he replied at once, renewing his chuckle. I don't reckon he'd have lent me all that money if he had known what was to happen to him. No, sir, I don't reckon he would, and never to take a note for it neither. 5,000 it was, and him telling me he didn't have no need for a note or any kind of a paper. So there was no proof I ever had the money off of him. Not at all. Just the two of us knowing it, and he setting a day 5 years after for him to come for his money and his due. 5 years. And this is the day. This is Wentworth's day.
He paused and favored me with a sly glance out of his eyes that were one and the same time dancing with suppressed mirth and dark with withheld fear.
Only he can't come, because it wasn't less than 2 months after that day that he got shot out hunting. Shotgun in the back of the head. Pure accident. Of course, there were them that said as how I'd done it a purpose, but I showed them how to shut up, because I drove into Dunwich and went straight to the bank, and I made up my will so's his daughter, that's Miss Jeanie, was to get all I die owing. Didn't make no secret of it either. Let them all know, so they could talk their fool heads off.
Nam lent Stark 5 Gs, but he didn't get it in writing that he lent him this money. So it's just his word. Then Stark and Nam go hunting, and Nam gets shot in the back of the head in a hunting accident, quotes. Mm-hmm. Since Stark owed him money, people doubt that it was an accident. But to say it wasn't, and when he dies, Stark's going to give everything he owes to Wentworth's daughter, Jeanie, to kind of make it seem like he wasn't intentionally killing him, that it was really an accident and he was trying to make good.
There's a great line in that quote, actually. It's my favorite line in the story when he says, I showed him how to shut up. And at this point I realized, oh, it's a profit deal. This is about money.
Yeah.
This is what the story is really going to get down to. That's probably it.
Yeah.
And for some reason I started climbing back on board with it at that point. This simple profit motive or I want my money back.
Right.
Took it right out of the cosmic thing, because I thought maybe the thing that would come to the windows would be a strange high house in the mist thing or something like that.
Right. But no, this is going to be a straight on Tales from the Crypt kind of.
Yeah. I borrowed some money from him and then we went out hunting and he accidentally got shot in the head. Who knows how that happened? And then today's the day he would have gotten his money back. I was like, oh, okay.
And that's the thing. Today is the day that he was due to pay back the debt. At midnight, he's clear and he doesn't have to worry about it anymore.
Once the day expires, then no longer does he have to worry about paying his debt back. Not that he should anyway, because the guy's dead.
Because he's not going to pay him back. How is he going to come back? I mean, come on. He's dead.
It doesn't matter anyway, because he says it's a good thing he can't come back, because I ain't got the money. Spent it. I don't know what he spent it on.
This weirds Fred out a bit, and he realizes how tired he is. Even Stark notices that he looks a little peaked. And he says, you want to take a rest? And he gives him a lamp and tells him he can go in the next room and rest on the couch. Fred agrees. On his way out of the room, he picks up the 7th book of Moses and takes it with him. And he settles in and starts looking it over. And there's some cool talk of demons and spells to cure illnesses and grant wishes. Mm-hmm. But there's this one part about a magical incantation that raises the dead. And this is the most ridiculous part of the whole story. Goes, oh man, this stuff is so crazy. I'm going to write it down. So he starts transcribing this. And then we get this really confusing sentence here. And having copied it, I was not loath to say it aloud several times, not for a moment expecting anything untowards to take place, nor did it. So I put the book aside and looked at my watch, 11 o'clock.
Right.
So I was not loath to say it out loud several times, yes. Not for a moment. So he did say it out loud several times.
But he had to put it in a weird negative way. I was not loath. I was not afraid to say it aloud several times, so I did it. I had to read it several times to get that too. But I jumped right back off this story at this point because I was like, what?
You got to be kidding me.
Like, look, if Wentworth had all these strange books, then maybe he was into the magic and stuff like that.
Yes.
And that's the reason that he can just come back from the dead, because he wants his money and he has the power to do it. And that's it.
Yeah.
Or this guy accidentally says a phrase out loud and it ends up raising the dead. Pick one.
Yeah.
But doing both is so dumb.
I agree.
Okay, so now the guy's going to come back for his money. But are you saying that he wouldn't have been able to do that if the stranger hadn't showed up and accidentally read this thing out loud from the book?
It's preposterous and totally lame. And
yes.
It really ruins the story that I was kind of interested in, even, actually.
It's just,
like you, I was on board and then I wasn't. So Fred sits there on the couch and he starts to feel a bit nervous about things, and he finds himself listening to the rain and trying to make out any sounds he may hear. You know, he's starting to get a little paranoid.
He thinks he can hear the incessant gnawing of mice.
And then he could hear Stark walking around, checking the locks and the doors and the windows and mumbling to himself. He says things like $150 a year. Let's see. Now it comes to $750. And he's talking about the interest that he would owe on the money. It's just so ridiculous. And he says some more stuff like, didn't know 'twas aimed at Nom. His conscience is troubling him. Then the whippoorwills start a calling. Dunwich War, the whippoorwills were the sign of death. Somebody was going to die, so.
And he says, oh, the whippoorwills are calling for a soul. Clem Whateley's dying. And I don't, what does that have to do with anything?
Nothing.
Just to mention the way this whole thing, it's like, why even bring the Dunwich stuff in for it at all?
There's no point.
You have a simple revenge story here.
Yep.
But I've noticed that Derleth will pull things in from other Lovecraft stories, whether they have relevance to the story or not. And, you know, setting is one thing. You could say, okay, Lovecraft created this place, so I can set any story I want there. Okay. But with names, like in this story, we were debating Nahum or Nom. That's because I just realized we had that debate before, and that's because that's the character in The Color Out of Space.
Oh, that's right.
Nahum Gardner.
Right.
And it's like, oh, I'll just pull that name. And it's the same in the story that we're going to read next week. The main character's called Wilbur. For no reason, other than Lovecraft had another character named Wilbur. It's just pointless.
Yeah.
Is it meant to bolster his claim that these are collaborations by using these character names?
But it doesn't make sense, because if he used them, why would he reuse the names again?
Exactly. It makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
I have felt no anger at all. This month, I should say.
Yeah.
A couple of people written in and gone, you guys are being pretty nice, actually, because this Derleth guy's a jerk. Other people are like, no, you know, on the other side of it. We do need to give him a little respect, whatever. But this was the first time I was reading something and just felt like, shut up.
Yeah.
You know, you're really just abusing this stuff.
This is a really bad job, even though it had the potential to actually be a decent revenge story.
Yeah, sure.
But he just really makes some really bad choices. It's frustrating.
Yeah.
So now in this part of the story, the narrator isn't sure what he saw. He is not sure if it was real, if he was dreaming. It's so crazy. It's so horrible. He doesn't know. It's one of those things.
Because this is our big climax.
He was dozing and he heard the whippoorwills get really loud as they got close to the house.
Maybe the Dunwich setting was just purely because he wanted to use the whippoorwill device.
Could be.
But it wakes him up.
And he goes to get out of bed and he hears a knock at the door, and that stops him in his tracks.
Right.
So he just stops and listens. Stark asked, who be ye? But there's no answer. And then Stark goes, it's past midnight. And then Fred looks down at his watch and he sees that it's not past midnight. And he realizes that Stark's clock is 10 minutes fast.
Right. Okay. I got back on board with the story again here because that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Why? Like, so Stark's clock was 10 minutes fast.
Yeah.
Which, okay, so he's so disconnected from town life that he doesn't, you know, go check with everybody else. He sets his own time out there. But if there's one thing you can count on, zombies will be on time. They have the correct time. Right? I mean, it's a standardized time was created in US and Canada, 1883.
Yeah.
Before that, people just kind of kept time, whatever your town said, whatever was on the church tower or whatever, right? The clock tower, whatever it was. And it, usually this was based off of the motion of the sun. So everybody was around the right way, but it wasn't totally the same. But apparently, in 1883, when they standardized it, the ancient powers of necromantic darkness were like, let's get on board with this too. This will now be only midnight if it's the same midnight that's standard across the country.
Yeah, are they on daylight savings as well?
Of course.
Well, that was by state, so the necromantic forces have to know what state they're in.
They do. They have to if they want to follow these rules. They're far more advanced than we give them credit for.
Yeah, they're really good. They really know what they're doing, these guys. This is what annoys me about it. Stark is like, oh, 10 minutes late. It doesn't even occur to him, maybe, that his watch is off.
Right.
Or that monsters and zombies don't care.
Yeah.
Why open the door? It's just ridiculous. If anybody knocked at the door and didn't answer, I wouldn't open it.
Well, they've already set up that he has all these locks and things. He's expecting some kind of trickery.
Yeah, why would he ever open it anyway?
It's 10 minutes after midnight, so there's no way the zombie's showing up now.
And I guess maybe if the zombie did show up, then he could laugh in its face and say, too bad.
You're late, you're late.
Ha ha, I win. I guess. I don't know what he's thinking. So Fred hears this horrible scream, and and then there's, no, no, get back. I ain't got it. I ain't got it. I tell you, go back. Then he's like, oh, shoot, I'm going to get out there. And he sees Stark on his back, sitting on his chest, is a skeleton.
Mm-hmm. A moldering skeleton. Its bony arms bowed above his throat, its fingers at his neck. And then in the back of the skull, the shattered bones where the charge of shot had once gone through. Definitely Wentworth.
The skeleton is strangling Stark. Fred finally faints. So maybe this is a Lovecraft story.
That was the note that he based it off of. Character sees something horrible, faints.
He comes to a few minutes later. The front door is wide open. The whippoorwills are still calling, and he looks at the body of Stark.
He lay where I had seen him, spread on the floor. My whole impulse was to escape that horrible scene as quickly as possible, but with decency impelled me to pause at Amos Stark's side to make sure that he was beyond my help. Was that fateful pause which brought the crowning horror of all, that horror which sent me shrieking into the night to escape that hellish place as were all the demons of the nether regions at my heels. For as I bent above Amos Stark, ascertaining that he was indeed dead, I saw sticking into the discoloured flesh of his neck the whitened finger bones of a human skeleton. And even as I looked upon them, the individual bones detached themselves and went bounding away from the corpse, down the hall and out into the night to rejoin that ghastly visitor who had come from the grave to keep his appointment with Amos Stark.
That's the end of the story.
Yeah.
Stinker.
Well, I have so many questions about this. If it was revenge.
Yeah.
It's revenge for shooting him in the back of the head. Why did the term of the loan matter at all? If Stark had the 5 G's and he paid off the skeleton, would it have been like, oh, okay. Well, that's great. Thank you for paying that. You know, because it's his lips, so that's what it sounds like. Thanks for the 5 G's, buddy. What's he going to do with the, what's the skeleton going to do with the money?
I don't know.
He was in there calculating interest. So it clearly he must have had some thought. Well, if he does come, he's probably going to wonder where that interest money goes. What did we agree on? 7-8%? I mean, it was so... It's such a violation of mood, too. You know, you can say, people point out, like, look, if Dreleth is doing terrible stuff, let's not deify Lovecraft too much. He had a lot of bad habits.
Sure.
And some of the things that Dreleth is doing is just imitations of those things. But one thing Lovecraft did know is that you had to create mood and you shouldn't violate it. And Picture in the House, it does this quite well. It tells you you're in this creaky old house. There's the rainstorm outside. There's a weird guy. Everything's about the sound in the house and the person walking down the stairs. He doesn't introduce any mystical stuff because it's unnecessary. There's no long passages about spells or anything like that.
No.
It's just the one weird book because he wanted to create that effect with the blood dripping from the ceiling. No skeleton tackling somebody and strangling them, which, by the way, that was before the italicized sentence. The only thing that was italicized at the end is that he had left finger bones behind on the guy's neck.
And then the finger bones crawl away.
How is that more horrifying than a full skeleton, you know, like professional wrestling a guy in the living room?
It's not more horrifying. Once you see a skeleton dude killing a guy, anything after that is a piece of cake.
Here's the thing. We talked about the first thing that we did was, what, The Survivor? And that actually was based off some kind of lengthy plot sketch.
Mm-hmm.
It had the lizard from Spider-Man in it. It was stuff that I hadn't really seen in Lovecraft before, necessarily.
Yeah.
Themes were there, but it did seem like maybe he would have written this Crocodile Man story.
Right.
Here, where are these notes from?
I have no idea.
Like, how is this a collaboration at all?
Probably something that came out of his Commonplace book. Probably a short little jaunt, and that was it.
But even then, you would go, oh, these notes in the Commonplace book, oh, he wrote this story already. You know?
I'm speculating here, but maybe it was man comes back from the dead to collect on a debt. Maybe that's all it was. And then he decided to tie in all of this stuff with the Dunwich Horror, the Whippoorwills, and the Picture in the House. He likes those stories and he was trying to emulate it.
I think that he somehow made a mental shift where he went, oh, old short stories are notes too, right? Like, it's just, he wrote that stuff down.
Yeah.
So I can collaborate on that with him, you know? Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Like if George Lucas dies.
Sure.
I can collaborate with him on the new Star Wars movies. I've got, me and George, we're doing a thing. It's called War Stars. New character, though. It's Han Skywalker.
Oh, hey, that sounds good.
He's a bounty knight, you know? Got an alien sidekick, Yodaka. They're fighting the Storm Vaders. It's all, you know, it's new.
It's good, yeah. You got it. You're doing taking new stuff there.
It's all new. I looked at his notes.
Well, that concludes our coverage of this story. I don't want to talk about it anymore. We're going to be doing another Derelict story in a couple days in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm excited about that. We're going to be doing the
Dark Brotherhood.
That's right, which I'm super excited about because it takes place in Providence, so it's perfect.
Yeah, as of this recording, I haven't finished it, but it's in Providence. It's got Lovecraft. It's got Poe.
Right.
It's got some alien stuff going on, and everything I can I have skimmed on it so far seems hilarious. I'm really excited to...
But we're not going to... You're not going to be hearing that. That's only for the people that... Unless you backed the Kickstarter, you'll be getting that. You'll have to wait a few weeks. But next week, you will be getting another Derelis story, The Gable Window.
The Gable Window is what we will be closing out August Derleth month with. Coincidentally, it's the month of August. So The Gable Window, for all you out in listening land, but for all of you who happen to be coming to Providence this weekend, you'll be hearing about the Dark Brotherhood.
You sure will. I want to thank Dion Winton Pollock for his great reading. Thank you so much for doing that for us. And if folks are interested, I recommend checking out Sunny with a Chance of Zombies. I haven't read it, but the title alone sells me.
Hey, yeah, I have zombie fatigue too. That sounds like something I want to check out.
I also want to remind folks that my Kickstarter for the sequel to Transreality, Transreality New Worlds, is still in full effect. It's going until the end of the month, so please get over there and contribute. I really want to make this book, and I need your help. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are here at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.